So I always give the teachings a title, but I don't normally use the projector to like put the notes and stuff up. So sometimes nobody knows what the title of the teaching was until later. And I often change it actually, after the fact, if I think there if a better title comes to my mind, or if there's a key point that kind of comes out in the sermon. And sometimes I think in terms of, because we do post them on social media, and I think, well, what might make somebody curious enough to listen to this teaching? And I don't know 100% that I'm going to use this. We'll see. But I think this time I might accomplish the goal of getting somebody curious, because the title I have at the top right now is A Tale of Two Cows. If you can believe that, there are actually some cows that figure very prominently in this story. So I wish my in-laws were here, because this would definitely be something they would be interested in. They spend a lot of their life around cows and pigs, and probably several of you would relate to that. So we are in 1 Samuel chapter 6 this morning. Last week in 1 Samuel 5, we read the story of how the Philistines, having captured the Ark of the Covenant because of Israel's disobedience, took it back to their city and set it down beside their idol of their god Dagon in their temple, apparently with the intent of sort of adding Israel's God to their pantheon, having the point of view that there were many gods, and if you the more you could of them you could get on your side, probably the better off you would be. This, of course, did not work out for them. God very definitively refuted the idea that he could be placed in a pantheon alongside a bunch of stone idols. And first, the idol of Dagon fell down on its face. The Philistines didn't quite get the message, set it back up. The next day, it fell on its face again and was broken, its head and its hands broken off. So at that point, the Philistines started to think, this is not working out too well. In addition, they were struck with plagues. The Bible doesn't specify, but it is speculated it may have even been bubonic plague, because there is a mention later on of mice or rats being involved in this plague as well. And it has been known for a long time that rats are carriers of bubonic plague. Now, going back this far, 3,000 years ago, of course, they had no idea what germs were or that rats necessarily caused it, but people did have some idea that they were connected with it in some form or fashion. Anyway, bubonic plague is very, very deadly. It results in the appearance of tumors on the body, which is another thing that's mentioned in this story. And so they started passing it around like a hot potato from city to city. As they started getting struck with plague in Ashkelon, they sent it to Ekron, and the Ekronites are like, no, don't bring it here, send it to Gath. And so they circulated among the five cities of the Philistines, and everywhere it went, people started to panic, saying, we do not want this thing here, get it away from us. So they were kind of getting the message, but they were kind of not getting the message. So we begin in 1 Samuel chapter 6 with verses 1 and 2. It says, the Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, what shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to his place. So they got the message that they needed to send the Ark back. But they could have gone further with this, and they should have gone further with this. When they saw their idol fall on its face before the Ark of the Covenant, which they had just captured from Israel, they had beaten the Israelites in battle, they captured the Ark, but then their idol falls on its face. Now, what would a rational thought process be at this point? Would it not be rational to ask, could it be that our God is not actually a God? And what we're dealing with here is the Creator God who actually has all power. God has made human beings, as I think the Westminster Catechism says, or one of the catechisms, it says that man is a reasonable creature. And of course, we know a lot of people that we wouldn't describe as reasonable, but what that's actually saying is man is a creature capable of reasoning, or as we would say, rational. The problem is that the way we use that capability is not always in service of the discovery of truth. We're not always looking to find out what the truth is. In some cases, in many cases, we are using our reason to actually cover up and obscure the truth. Truly rational creatures, like the fictional Mr. Spock on Star Trek, they would start with trying to find out what is true and then use that reason to figure out what they ought to do in light of that truth. But human beings very frequently, and to our detriment, do the opposite of this. We first decide what we want to do, and then we use our reason to find out a way to justify it. Is this actually reflected in the English language itself? So we have the word rational, that means capable of reasoning, and then we have the verb form, which is rationalize. And to rationalize literally means to use your reason to justify something that you've already decided that you want to do. So sometimes we're not really that rational. And when confronted with a truth claim, we ought to be doing one of two things. We ought to be either rejecting it outright and saying, no, I don't believe that's true, and just move on with your life, or accepting it as true and then doing the things that that acknowledgement would seem to require and necessitate. But quite often, that's not what we do. We try to find some kind of a middle way where we can acknowledge, yeah, that's true, but then we go on to do things that don't make sense in light of it being true. I was quite surprised, or somewhat surprised anyway, to learn that in 2020, Lifeway conducted a study in which they asked American adults if they believed that Jesus Christ was physically resurrected as described in the scriptures. Two-thirds of American adults said yes. Two-thirds believe in the physical bodily resurrection of Christ, supposedly. However, here's the problem with that. If Jesus Christ rose from the dead, then it follows that he was who he claimed to be, namely the Son of God, who is coming again to judge the world. If Jesus Christ is the Son of God who is coming again to judge the world, it does not make sense to not obey his commands, to not acknowledge him as Lord and take him as Savior, because you are then expecting that judgment to come. So the truth is, you know, James says faith, if it does not have works, is dead. This is a belief, in a sense. It's an acknowledgement of what is true, but without the following through of the actions that a real acknowledgement and belief of that truth would require. We don't really allow the truth to master us. We actually, as human beings, quite often attempt to master it in some way. We try to control things, and as a result, we do what Paul describes in Romans 1 as actually suppressing the truth of God. So Romans 1, beginning in verse 18, Paul's talking about the Gentiles, like the Philistines, those who do not have a direct revelation from God. And he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." So idolatry, which the Philistines and pretty much all the other peoples other than Israel in the world at that time were practicing, results in what Paul calls a futile thinking, a supposed wisdom that is actually just foolishness. And the more people insist on suppressing the truth and following after these lies and delusions, the further away they get from God and the less reasonable they become. Until we get to verse 28 of Romans 1, where Paul says, "And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done." What Paul is telling us is that to reject the knowledge of God, to suppress that truth, leads ultimately to rejecting logic and reason and to becoming unreasonable creatures. Because all of those things come from God to begin with. And when you reject God, you've rejected the whole package. People don't want to do that. They'd like to be able to take a piece and say, we can be wise, we can be reasonable, we can have logic and truth without God. Maybe one of the most graphic illustrations of the fact that that does not work is something we are seeing unfold in our own society today. There was a time, very recently, in my own lifetime, when if you had printed a headline in the paper that said, "Men are not women," people would have thought that was just a ridiculous thing to say, because why would you bother to make such an obvious statement? That'd be like saying horses are not airplanes. I mean, what's the point of saying that? Well, guess what would happen if you printed that today? If an editor put that line, let alone a headline, just made the statement in the New York Times, they would lose their job the next day. How did we get to this place where we cannot state provable biological truths that are grounded in observable reality? That's not a theological statement. That's a scientific statement. But a large portion, I don't know how large, because they're very loud and perhaps not as large as you think, but a significant portion of our society has rejected that truth. They are suppressing even that truth. So you have some people like famous atheist Richard Dawkins has kind of gone, whoa, whoa, whoa. But no, there's two sexes. I mean, he kind of waffles on it a little bit, but he's like, this is not good. And there's other atheists, I can't remember their names, but some other atheists that are really pushing back hard against all this. They're going, no, this is just another crazy religion. We don't need this. And they are now being ostracized. But the thing is, they're being devoured by their own monster, because what they did when they told people there's no God is that they disconnected from the source of absolute truth. And now it's just a sea of opinions. And if a man says, my opinion is that I could be a woman, then who are you to say that he can't? That's just your opinion versus his opinion. Nothing can be absolutely true anymore. As Nietzsche said, you know, we've wiped away the horizon. And now there's no up or down. Now there's no forward or back. There's no dark or light. There's no right or wrong. That's what happens when you suppress the truth. And so the Philistines, they were in this situation where they had actually suppressed the truth. They had embraced idolatry. The same, I might add, as we are doing today in our country. You know why we're at this point of the insanity of transgenderism taking over at certain levels in academia and media? We are at that point because we embraced the idol of supposed autonomy over our bodies, and we can do whatever we want, and we can reject divine morality. And now we're in this condition of not being able to tell the difference between a man and a woman. When you determine that you're going to keep your idols no matter what, this is what happens. So we go back to the Philistines, we find they're doing the same thing. They are just as attached to their idols as we are to ours. So instead of repenting of their idolatry, instead of recognizing, hey, this is not a god, this is a piece of stone, and there is an actual power that can knock this down. So instead of following through rationally, they decide they need to pay their dues to this foreign god whom they've offended. So this is what the advice the priests gave them when they were called in, back in 1 Samuel 6, beginning in verse 3. They said, if you send away the Ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. And they said, what is the guilt offering that we shall return to him? They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So must you make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land, and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he had dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away, and they departed? You know, it's really interesting. The Philistines knew the history. They actually knew what had happened to the Egyptians. They knew about the plagues. They knew that Pharaoh had hardened his heart. They knew that Egypt had been all but destroyed by the plagues when they refused to let the Israelites go. So they knew something about who the God of Israel was. But they didn't want to give up their idols. They didn't want to worship the one true God. They just wanted to kind of buy him off. They wanted to say, okay, we're sorry we took your ark. Here's some golden offerings. Please don't kill us. That's basically the approach that they decided to take. Now, they weren't entirely wrong in the whole concept of a guilt offering. That was something that was actually instituted by the law of Moses. But sacrifices of any kind were never intended to take the place of a relationship with God. God's people were commanded to offer sacrifice within their covenantal relationship with God, primarily to express their faith in the God who would send his son eventually as a sufficient offering for sin. Because Paul said, those sacrifices, whoever wrote Hebrews said, those sacrifices could never take away sin. It wasn't a case of buying God off, of paying for your sin, because you couldn't. Because the soul that sins will die. So death was the punishment. And there was not enough gold in the entire world. There were not enough animals to offer. There would never be anything in the way of a sacrifice that humans could offer that could restore our relationship with God. So sacrifices were about an expression of faith and obedience to God, who himself was going to provide the sufficient offering. Unfortunately, this idea that we can somehow pay our dues to God and maintain this kind of relationship with him has not lost its popularity in the past 3,000 years. If anything, I think it's more popular than ever. I would argue that this is the religion of just about everyone who is religious at all in any way, shape, or form in the world today, except for those whose trust is actually in Christ as Savior. Anyone who has not accepted the efficacy, the complete sufficiency of Christ's atonement, well, they've still got an unpaid bill. They still have to buy God off. They still have to pay their dues. And the really sad thing is that many people who identify themselves as Christians and who may at least verbally agree with the idea that Jesus paid our sin debt nevertheless see themselves as being in a relationship with God that is basically transactional in nature. I call it vending machine religion. So you put in your dollar. It's probably not a dollar anymore. It's probably $1.25 with inflation. And you have a reasonable expectation if the vending machine is working, you'll get your candy bar. And this is how people look at it. You know, the churches in America famously filled up right after 9/11, after the terrorist attacks. And some people criticized the church for not having the answers for the people that came because they all left again just as quickly. And there's probably some truth in that criticism, but I also think the vast majority of the people who went to church after 9/11 were not interested in giving up their idols. They were not interested in repenting of their sins and turning to the true God. They wanted something from him. They wanted some sense of peace or purpose or hope. They wanted some comfort for the trauma that our country was enduring. And they were willing to give a little of their time in exchange for that. Many, many people that fill up churches that are sitting in church pews this morning, that is what they're looking for. They're looking to make some kind of a deal, some kind of a bargain. God, I'll give you a little of my time. I'll give up this sin. I'll do this good thing. I'll give you some of my money, and you'll give me some blessings, right? Right? God's not a vending machine. But more than that, when you pursue this kind of a transactional relationship with God, you are placing yourself in the place of a heathen, like the Philistines who didn't even know God and who were in no covenant with him. And so all they could think to do was to buy him off and to send him some golden offerings in the hopes that they would evade some of his judgment. You are treating yourself as a slave, according to what Paul wrote in Galatians 4, verses 4 to 7. But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. I've talked about this so many times, but it is burning in my heart how many Christians see themselves in relation to God as though they were slaves. As though the best they could hope for is that they could get a little corner of his house to live in and get a few of his blessings, and he'd basically leave them alone and they go to heaven when they die. The Son of God died on a cross and spilled his blood, not so that you could give God a little bit of dues and get a few blessings in return and escape some of his wrath, so you could be his child. And the relationship of a child is completely different from the relationship of a slave or an employee who just expects to give a little and get a little in return. The child has everything that belongs to the parents. He is an heir. That means that whatever the parents have also belongs in some sense to the child. Even though the parent remains in control of it, the child knows that's my inheritance. Everything I see, I own this. This is mine. That is the relationship that God always wanted to have with humanity, and that is why he sent his son to make it possible, why he paid the highest price that has ever been paid for anything. And to sell that short and to downgrade yourself to a relationship where you're just giving God something and hoping for something in return, that is so sad. And I know that it grieves the heart of God so terribly when people come to him and they try to make a deal and they say something like, oh, well, I'll give up smoking if you let me date this girl. I feel like God is just like, you know, head exploding emoji. I gave my son for you. How are you coming to me and asking for such small things? What he asks for, what he in fact requires, is that we come to him with the same heart that a little child has in coming to their parent. Jesus made this explicitly clear in Matthew 18, verses 1 to 4. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" I think Jesus' answer in this must have shocked them as much as anything he ever said. And calling to him a child, verse 2, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Why are children the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? I can tell you from experience, and any of you who have ever had kids will know, it is not because they are without sin, or at least without the effects of sin. That's not the case. Children are given to us as a model for who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven because they are completely without purchasing power. They are completely without control. They don't come and try to make bargains, at least not to get to a certain age. Little children expect to receive from their parents what they need, and if they have good parents, they get it. Why? Because they are your children. There is nothing I would not give my children if it is in my power and I believe it is for their good. But I am not perfect as a father. God is perfect as a father. And God will always give because he always knows what is good for us. He will always give us what is for our good. We can have complete confidence in that. And this is the door that he has thrown wide open for us in Christ to say, "Come into my house and become my child." How could you say no? How could you say, "I'd rather sit here by the curb and root through your trash can and see if I can find something in there," or "I'd rather come to your door and rattle my cup as a beggar," and or "I'd rather try to make a deal with you," when you could be adopted, when you could be his child? This is what he has made possible for us in Christ. But as we go back to 1 Samuel 6, we see, of course, none of this was known to the Philistines. They did not even follow the light that they had, which is the light, although it was dim at times, that came from Israel as God's covenant people. They were supposed to be reflecting that, and the nations around them were supposed to see that, and they were supposed to want to follow God. But the Philistines rejected even that. They didn't want any piece of the covenant. They didn't want to be God's followers. They wanted their idols. So they decided, okay, we just got to get rid of it. We just got to get rid of the ark. It's causing us nothing but trouble. This God of Israel is judging us. So let's send him back a bribe and hope that he will stop killing us with plagues. But you know, interestingly, they still had some doubts. They were still clinging so hard to their idols. They were like, maybe this whole thing was a coincidence. I mean, yeah, the idol fell over two nights in a row and got broken. Yeah, everywhere we sent the ark, they had plagues and died. Maybe it was just a coincidence. Maybe we do one more test and make sure that it was actually the God of Israel that did this. So this is what the priests came up with, verses 7 to 10. "Now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never come a yoke. Yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves home away from them. Take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart, and put in a box at its side the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go on its way. And watch, if it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence." And I think that was the outcome they were really hoping for, because then they could reassure themselves that, well, our idol isn't really without power. It was just one big coincidence. It was actually a pretty clever scheme that they came up with, because they were relying on the natural world to show them something about the supernatural world. I didn't used to understand this as a child until I got around cows. And then I started to understand why this was such a big deal. Okay, so when they did what they did, they were asking basically God to prove who he was by overriding the natural instincts of these animals in at least three very significant ways. First of all, they were having to override their parental instinct. So if you've ever been around where when cows are being weaned, when the calves are being separated from the mamas. It's actually really sad. If you're empathetic like me, you feel sorry for the cows because the calves are over here in the paddock and the mamas are over here in the pasture and the mamas are just bawling trying to get to the calves and the calves are bawling because they don't want to be separated. This is a very strong instinct that God has put into animals to care for their young. So what they were telling them to do is take the mama cows, shut up their calves at home. You know what they're going to do. They're going to go right back. If you don't stop them, they're going to go right back to their calves, right? So that's the first instinct they had to run. But there's two more. The second instinct, these cows had never had a yoke put on them. Do you know what happens when you take an adult animal that has never been yoked and you put a yoke on it and try to get it to pull a cart? It's probably going to kick the cart to pieces. That's probably what's going to happen. Animals do not naturally respond this way. They don't naturally just take to a yoke and start pulling the cart and doing work when there's no one there driving them. The third way in which these cows were having to override their instinct, or which God was having to override it, was fear. The cow is naturally a prey animal. It's not a predator animal. And because of that, it tends to be very skittish. Cows do not like to go places that they haven't gone before. So what they've done in some cattle handling systems, they've actually designed them with curves. And the purpose of those curves is to make the cows think they're going in a circle. Because then they feel like they're going somewhere where they've already been and it's probably safe. But to take a cow away from its calf, put a yoke on it, it's never had a yoke before, and expect it to go walking down a road that it has never been down to a place it has never been, that's impossible. Naturally speaking, this should not have happened. There was no way that this could have happened. So what did happen? We probably know, but before we get to that part of the story, I want to try to draw you a little bit of a parallel here that might be surprising. I want to read some statements of Jesus with regard to what it takes to be his disciple. And I want you to think about those instincts that those cows were having to have overridden to do what they needed to do to take the ark back to Israel. Luke 14, verse 26, Jesus said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Matthew 11:26, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Matthew 16:24, "Then Jesus told his disciples, 'If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.'" What does the call of discipleship require of you and me? It requires that we override every natural instinct. It requires that we be ready to walk away from our families, including our children if necessary. It requires that we willingly take Christ's yoke, which means that we accept restrictions on our lives willingly, out of our desire to be in line with his will. It requires that we go towards the thing we are afraid of instead of running from it. I mean, we're very used to glossing over this, take your cross and follow. Do you know what that means? The cross is an instrument of torture and death. To take your cross and follow Jesus means you are walking right towards one of the most horrible ways to die that there was. That's what it means. Everything in human nature rebels against that. The survival instinct might be the strongest one there is, even overcoming the parental instinct. And Jesus is saying, if you want to be my disciple, you have to walk right towards the thing that you least want. So what did the cows do? Verse 10, the men did so. Took two milk cows, yoked them to the cart, shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. You know who's in charge of nature? Nature's God. What is stronger than the animal instinct? The will of the creator of that instinct. It is not that animals don't have, I think, in some sense, their own will. It is that they don't have the freedom to choose it the way that we do. And therefore, when the Creator God wanted something done, these animals just did it. They overrode every single one of their natural instincts, and they seemed to be excited about it. You know, this is a crazy thing. I was asking Daisy this last night because she's been around cows more than I have. Why would cows moo? Like, I mean, this was, we call it mooing. In this text, it's lowing. Well, one reason that they do that, again, is when they're separated from their calves, but they're trying to get back to them. These cows are walking in the opposite direction, away from their calves. You know what the other reason that you often hear cows mooing, vocalizing? It's they're excited because they're about to be fed. When my father-in-law feeds the cows, he often will honk the horn on his truck right before he spreads the feed out because it creates an association. And that way, if he needs to take the cows somewhere, he doesn't necessarily have to feed them. He can just honk his horn and they'll follow. And they'll immediately all start be mooing and they'll be following because they're about to be fed. These animals were, in some sense, I think, excited to be doing their Creator's will, because that is what all of creation was meant to do. The Bible tells us that all of creation is singing the praises of God. All of creation is glorifying Him. What part of creation is not glorifying God? People. Because people have a choice. Because God gave us that choice to be able to say, no, I want to do my will, not your will. When the Philistines saw these animals going against every natural instinct, it was proof to them that the power of God was at work. What will people think around us if they see us as disciples of Christ going against every one of our natural instincts to follow Him? How powerful a testimony will that be when they know that we do have a choice? That we could just play it safe, that we could live for the things of this world, that we could stay in our comfort zones and push for our rights and want to be respected and honored in the here and now. Can we bring Him as much honor as two cows did 3,000 years ago? Verse 14 of chapter 6, the cart came into the field of Joshua Beth-Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them up upon the great stone. And the men of Beth-Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages, the great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth-Shemesh. There's some fascinating prophetic details in this story that it's pretty easy to miss. If you recall, when the ark of God was first brought into the promised land, it was under the leadership of Joshua. Now the ark is coming back after its long absence, and it stops in the field of Joshua. Joshua, in case you weren't aware, is simply the Hebrew form of the name Jesus. Joshua, when he crossed the River Jordan, he sent the ark ahead on the shoulders of the priests. The waters receded, and they crossed over on dry land. And when all the Israelites had crossed, Joshua said, I want you to take stones, and I want you to create a pile of those stones as a witness of what God did here today. Now it happens again. The ark comes back, and there's a stone in Joshua's field that becomes a witness of what happened. The stone, of course, is also a symbol of Christ, stone that was rejected by the builders, which became the cornerstone. Beth-Shemesh means house of the sun, that is S-U-N, perhaps very much like Malachi 4:2, in which this is said of the Christ, but to you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in his wings. That's from the New King James Version. All this pointing to the fact prophetically that the presence of Jehovah God would ultimately return, not through the Ark of the Covenant, but through the Son of God, Jesus Christ. Did you notice what happened to the cows, by the way? They got offered as a sacrifice. I'm not sure how many times I turned to Romans 12:1. I'm probably going to keep doing it until I die. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Brothers and sisters, our purpose in this world is to do by choice what those animals did by instinct. Their highest instinct that they had was to do the will of the Creator no matter what it was, even though it resulted in their ultimately being killed and offered as burnt offerings. We have a choice. And Paul says, this is what I want you to do. This is what I urge you to do. Don't wait to be forced into it. Offer yourselves a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. Prove what is His will. That is, through your lives, align your choices, align every moment of your life with the will of your Creator. Walking away from all that we naturally desire and toward all that we naturally fear is the way we show the world that He's worthy, that He's God, that He really is who He claims to be, that we're not just sitting here Sunday after Sunday talking about it and singing about it and then going and doing all the same things that the world does. It has to be something different. It has to be as striking as it was to the Philistines to see cows walking away from their calves, taking a yoke that they'd never had before and walking down a road towards something they should have been afraid of and going straight to where? The field of Joshua. In other words, they led people to Jesus. That's what your job is and my job is. It is to go in such a way that people see the difference in our lives. And if they follow us, they will find where we're going. We are going to Jesus. We are going where He is because that is what He did. He literally offered Himself as a sacrifice. He didn't just sacrifice things that He wanted. He literally got on an altar which was shaped like a cross and let nails be driven through His hands and feet and poured out His soul to death. Some altars are public like His was, or like Stephen's was when he was stoned. And when he said, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. And I've always wondered what kind of an impression that made on the young man named Saul who was watching. He was running as hard as he could in the opposite direction then. But I'm sure that it stuck in his mind, why would a man do that? Why would a man who's being killed offer forgiveness to the men who were killing him? That's against every natural instinct. Why would someone offer their lives? Why would someone put themselves out when they don't have to? Why? We want people to be asking why. And if we're doing the same things everyone else is doing, why would they? Some altars are public, some altars are private. Some altars you may think no one but God even notices. Day after day, you're making the choices and you're trying to do what's right and you're seeking for the Holy Spirit to bring the fruits of the Spirit in your life, but you don't see where anyone is noticing. Let me assure you, God notices. And this is the way in which we honor Him. Whether the altar is public or whether it is private, whether it is some great thing that we are being called to, such as laying down our physical life as the martyrs did, or whether it is dying daily to all of our desires and living for His desires. He is honored. He sees. He knows. Submit your will to His will. Find your altar. Because when you found it, you will also have found your purpose.